Hey, this is the members-only edition of Parallel for 2019, and I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. This is normally a podcast about tech and accessibility, but it's about some other stuff tonight. And first, I'm going to introduce my very special guest, and then I'm going to give you the plugs for why you should be and stay a member and how happy we are to have you. My special guest on Parallel is neither a bona fide mainstream tech journalist type person or podcaster, nor is he a expert in accessibility. He is, however, an experienced podcaster in this here podcast studio. He is my very own husband, Frank, who's a Linux programmer. Well, you're a programmer. You're not a Linux programmer, but you use Linux a lot. Hi, welcome to the show.
Why, hello.
See, this is why he was super popular. So the couple of reasons that we invited Frank on the show, we being me, a couple of reasons I invited Frank on the show. First and foremost, he was the star of a thing called Shelley's Podcast, which may sound weird because it was called Shelley's Podcast. But I did this show where I would talk about whatever was going on in my life, and I would occasionally bring him on the show to talk, and people would call in back when we had, you know, a feedback line. And they would call in and they would go, what is Frank coming back? When is he coming back? And so I would have him on. And so very popular episodes. What were some topics that we used to talk about on the show?
Digging, house repair, projects.
Yeah, those were your topics, not so much mine.
Yeah, well, you know.
I talked about cocktails. I talked about
lady things.
Cocktails are lady things. That's exactly right. But we thought we'd do a special edition of Parallel for members of Relay. And a lot of you may not have been fans of Shelley's podcast, but somewhere out there in the world there are, because I run into you. And I run into you at the weirdest places. I run into Shelley's podcast fans at tech conferences. I've actually had meetings, interviews with people from tech companies. And at some point at the end of the meeting, they've leaned over to me and they've said, Shelley, so how's Frank? Because I'm a fan of Shelley's podcast and I really need to know if he ever finished the remodel on your house. Did you ever?
No. Well, what is finished?
I know, right? Another thing that I used to podcast about a long time ago, movies. I like old movies, classic movies. And my favorite film actors were Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, and I used to do a thing called the Tracy Hepburn Podcast. And I've made Frank watch a lot of Tracy Hepburn movies with me.
Torture.
And I
Such
thought...
sweet torture.
I thought, yeah, and there's Boris Karloff isn't in any of them. I thought it would be fun to invite the cats on the air. Is that Norbert out there?
That's Norbert. Should I put him outside?
I think you probably should. All right, hold please while we put Norbert outside. And we're back. Just at the point where I was about to tell you what's going to happen on this podcast, it is a movie review of a Tracy Hepburn film. This is what I call a gateway movie. It's the kind of movie that you show to people who may not be fans of the same kind of movies that you normally like, but there's something in common. There's some commonality about this movie for those people. And in this case, it is computers, it is technology. The movie we're going to watch and talk about today, we've watched it already. Spoiler alert, the movie we're going to talk about today is Desk Set, made in 1957. It stars Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, two favorites of mine, and there's a computer in it as well. We've seen it a few times, and we're just going to roll through some of our thoughts. We watched it probably a little longer ago than we should have. We watched it about a week ago, and then we kind of got busy and didn't do the show, but we made a lot of notes. We're just reading our notes over. We listened to the movie's commentary again. I went and did some further reading. So we'll set the scene a little bit. We'll tell you a little bit about where we are in time when Desk Set is made. Made in 1957, 20th Century Fox. It's directed by a guy named Walter Lang, who had just done some Fox musicals, including The King and I, which was surprising to me. I didn't realize he was a musical director. And this movie is in CinemaScope. So in addition to your old computer joy from the 1950s, you get to see a really small sort of movie on a really big canvas. It's kind of weird that Desk Set is in CinemaScope, but it is. That's kind of fun.
It's pretty. They have nice colors.
Nice colors. Well preserved. Yeah, we watched it on DVD. There's a Blu-ray version now also, and there'll be plenty of links to streaming and to Blu-ray and to DVD in the show notes. The advantage to the Blu-ray and DVD is that there is a mediocre commentary if you want. So it was the eighth movie that Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn made together. They made nine in total. The next one would occur 10 years later. Guess who's coming to dinner? Before this, it had been 5 years since they had made a movie and together. It was called Pat and Mike. And Tracy is 57 years old, and he looks it. And Katharine Hepburn is 49 or so. Wait, yeah, 50. She's 50. And I think she probably look. I think they probably look their age, and I think they're a little old for the movie. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, he definitely looks a lot older than she does, however.
Yeah, he does. And the thing about it is, I think it would be sensible for them to be like, you know, I could buy 40. Even 35 would work. But the degree to which Hepburn and her colleagues talk about getting married, I don't know. It just seems like it would make sense. And most of her colleagues, except for one, are younger, considerably younger than she is.
However, the actors didn't try to play younger than they were.
Correct.
You know, there's some movies where there's like some old geezer and he's like, oh God, guy, you know, quit flirting with this person who's could be your daughter.
No, there's no creepiness.
Grandchildren.
There's sort of incidental creepiness, but it doesn't have to do with the age difference or anything. And, you know, Tracy and Hepburn are still in the same ballpark. But as a romantic couple, and that's the other thing, I think a flaw of the movie is that it takes a while for them to put them together as a couple. And so because of their age and because of that, you're kind of wondering, what's this about? Is she going to end up with anybody? Is she not? What's going to happen? Another interesting thing about this movie it was written by Phoebe and Henry Efron, who are the parents of Nora Efron. You may be familiar with her as a writer, as the author of When Harry Met Sally, all that kind of stuff. So comedy runs in her DNA, I guess. And some of the other actors in the movie, Gig Young, who at the time, this is the kind of stuff that interests me. It's irrelevant to the movie, but at the time he was married to Elizabeth Montgomery, who played Samantha on Bewitched. So I don't know, for some reason I like to imagine, and he was a bad husband apparently. So Gig Young, big alcoholic, not nice to women necessarily. He also had played this kind of part where he's like the boyfriend of the female lead but doesn't end up getting the female lead in the end, and he'd played that part a number of times in movies, which is kind of a weird specialty. Another actress in this movie that's pretty fun to watch is Joan Blondell. If you've watched any early 30s musicals or precos from Warner Brothers, Joan Blondell is a fixture in a lot of those movies. She's sort of a wisecracking, gum-chewing, good-hearted dame.
Fast talker.
Very funny. Like, she has most of the laugh lines. The setup is that Hepburn is sort of the leader of this office full of women, and the other three, and Joan Blondell, I guess, is her second in command, and they're similar in age. And most of the jokes that Hepburn has are with Joan Blondell, or if Joan Blondell isn't initiating the jokes.
Well, and Joan Blondell is not just a comedian. She can do drama very well, you know, and be a very concerned and actress and someone good that an actor can play off of, and she has really good reaction.
Yeah, not in this movie so much.
No.
I mean, that's not the next one. This is interesting to me, and she doesn't have a very big role, but Dina Merrill is of very wealthy parents. She is the daughter of E.F. Hutton. Remember those old commercials when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen, and Marjorie Merriweather Post, as in Post cereal, and she was a daughter of that family, so wealthy like crazy. She decided to become an actress, and there's two interesting Dina Merrill facts I'll give you. One is that years later, she married for a third time, and she married a guy named Ned Hartley, and the two of them together bought what was left of RKO Studios. And so she was not an actress at that point anymore, but I just thought it was interesting that they ended up buying RKO.
Well, you mentioned the E.F. Hutton ads, and when I think of that, that was the same era, I think it was PBS, where you'd have the E.F. Hutton ads, as well as the Burlington, and also IBM. And so...
Oh, bringing it around, bringing it full circle.
Yes.
another thing, and this is just super random, I like a recipe site on the web called Recipe Source, and I discovered it years before food sites were as big a deal on the web as they are now, and it's just text only, which is just delightful to me. So you look for recipes, and I found a recipe for mussels marinara, and it just is called Dina Merrill's Mussels. And apparently there was a celebrity cookbook at some point, and all those recipes have ended up on Recipe Source. But I have made Dina Merrill's mussels many times. Do you like they're the ones with marinara sauce in them?
Are yes, they good? They're quite good.
Thanks, Dina Merrill. There are a couple of other younger actresses who work in Katharine Hepburn's office with her. And apparently Tracy and Hepburn both interviewed those actors to see whether they were suitable for the part. And there was sort of a publicity gimmick where Hepburn interviewed these people who were graduates of the American Academy of Dramatic Art in New York and sort of made a publicity thing out of it. And that's how we ended up with Sue Randall and Dina Merrill and not Joan Blondell. She didn't have to go through that process. But apparently Tracy interviewed, maybe it was Sue Randall, and Hepburn interviewed Dina Merrill and presumably liked her. So she got the job. So Death Set takes place in a television network. This is essentially an office comedy. And at the beginning of the movie, you see the exterior of the building, the fictional Federal Broadcasting System. But it is, in fact, the RCA/GE building in New York, which is very tall. Mm-hmm. But it is based on various networks, based more on CBS than it is. Somebody had written a memoir about working as a reference librarian in a television network, and the play isn't directly based on it, but it has some relationship to it. Death Set was a play and had moderate success in the mid-50s. Shirley Booth played the lead in the play, and then they adapted it to film.
And the movie definitely reflects the business attitude of the 50s, and I guess even the 40s a bit, is that big business was big. Large building, lots of granite, concrete, huge offices.
CEO of the president of the network has this enormous office, and I read something about them having designed the office very specifically and to fill up the CinemaScope screen. So that again, it's like, hey, we have this widescreen stuff, so let's make a giant office space, even if it's only in like two scenes. What's funny about it.
Well, and in the movie, the CEO mentions to Tracy that he has a identical office on another floor, and Tracy can borrow it if he wants to.
You know? I forgot about that.
Yes.
So basically the plot, let's go through that fairly quickly, and feel free to jump in at any point if you wish. So it takes place at a fictional television network, and Katharine Hepburn and her team are essentially the reference department, and they are not computerized, which is kind of the point of the movie. And Spencer Tracy is a consultant. And this was funny because I always remembered them identifying him as an efficiency expert. But there's actually a line in the movie where they say, oh, no, efficiency expert is old hat. He's a methods engineer. Have you ever heard of a methods engineer? I have not.
No, but it has been a while.
We learn a lot about the office gossip because when Tracy comes to the CEO's office and then ends up in the reference department, the people in the various departments are on the phone to one another. There's a lot of split screens with, hey, this guy is coming down to see you, and I don't know who he is, but be warned.
People lurking behind the water coolers.
Oh, yes. There's this one woman who's like lurking behind the water cooler through the whole movie.
Well, there's this woman who just shows up periodically in an office. It's this little old lady, and you're not quite sure why she's there, but apparently the rest of the staff know her quite well, but she's never explained to us. But she just shows up and does something and has a reaction and leaves.
She didn't have any lines, so I guess she didn't get paid all that much, but she could tell her grandkids, I was in that Tracy Hepburn movie, just, you know, in costume or whatever. So basically the job of the reference department is to answer the phone and be Google. So if you want to know what kind of car the King of the Watusis drives in the movie King Solomon's Mines, you wouldn't go to Google or IMDb. You would call the reference department, and Katharine Hepburn or one of her assistants would. In the first part of the movie, all the information comes straight out of their heads. So presumably they have a lot of answers that they, you know, use frequently. And then sometimes they make a show of going up this really cool sort of spiral set of stairs to various shelves full of books and other parts of the department to look stuff up.
Well, you could imagine that in a large broadcasting company that you have a fact-checking department. You must have a reference department that finds things, you know, digs up trivial information or important information and make sure that everything that they say is factually accurate.
Basically, they're answering the phone all the time and giving this information, and Hepburn, as the chief of this department, is basically telling her minions to go off and find particular bits of information. They seem to each have specialties, and there's a new employee, and then there are a couple who have been around a while. They all seem to be friends. They trade office gossip. They talk about their love lives or lack thereof. They borrow money from each other, and Katharine Hepburn has a philodendron in her office that is quite enormous.
Yes, it goes around and around.
Yeah, it's like not standing. It's
like, goes around the perimeter.
All the way around the perimeter of the top of the office, which is a nice decorative touch. And apparently Hepburn like took that plant after the shoot was over. That's what I've read.
Well, it's bound to have taken quite a while to grow something that big.
Interesting thing to me, there were a lot of numerology references in that movie. I didn't know numerology was a thing people even talked about in the 50s, but people would be introduced to one another and they would say, well, there are this many letters in your name, which has this symbolism in terms of numerology. And I was just like, okay. So it's this combination of like super nerdy referency, like I know all this information, and then all of a sudden they would just like spout off with your name means such and such in numerology.
Yeah, I imagine it was just showing off, and it's just random little bits of information that you'd look at someone and sort of in awe that they could do it, but
hey, I don't know. It was weird though. So office movies were big in this day and age and continued for like 5 or 10 years. And it was funny because I watched Mad Men. Frank didn't. But when I read an article about Matthew Weiner having watched a lot of movies from this era, including The Apartment, which is probably the best known sort of like New York office sex hijinks comedy. But in the 50s, like the last half of the 50s, there were a lot of office comedies and dramas, like Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, and this movie was one of the lesser lights. There's a movie called Patterns, and there's some of them are office intrigue at a much higher level, and some of them, like this movie, actually include women, because most of those office movies, if you think about it, women are either non-existent or they're, you know, the floozy who is being passed around from dude to dude. But in this case, even though the women are talking a lot about their love lives and, you know, they don't pass the Bechdel test, they did pass the Bechdel test some, but not all the time. At least there's enough women that you don't feel like you're just like smothered by white dudes.
Right. And there's not really a bunch of butt pinching or anything like that that were in a number of movies of that era.
So the whole premise of the movie is that everybody is scared to death that Spencer Tracy is there to replace them with some sort of electronic brain because he's a methods engineer. And Hepburn, in her first scene, she comes in just having gone to IBM to see the electronic brain. So there's the first name drop IBM gets. And then a lot of the movie is spent trying to figure out whether Tracy is there, in fact, to replace the women in the reference department. It doesn't help that he keeps wandering around with a tape measure.
yes.
And he sort of like behaves in weirdly suspicious ways. And I actually think
he's sort of a mad scientist, sort of.
Yeah, kind of.
Absent-minded mad scientist.
Yeah, they throw in a lot of bits about him leaving things at various places. Hepburn at one point discovers that he's wearing non-matching socks, which is proof that he lives alone, which is both a mad scientist thing and your possibility, even though she has this sort of no-account boyfriend, Gig Young, who is a vice president of the company, and he kind of takes her for granted, and they've been dating 7 years, but they haven't gotten married, and she writes his financial reports for him. And
I think that he views her as a means to forward his career. You know, he has this vision that at some point he'll become a VP and that he'll then need a wife as decoration.
But he's like really mediocre and he knows it. And that's the thing about it. It's kind of like he's very cheerful about saying, hey, it would be great if you would write this financial report for me and then I can take credit for it. And because I can take credit for it and they promote me to vice president, then we can get married. So you have some interest in it. But I'm going to, you know, use your work cheerfully and take credit for it. And he's boring. There's nothing very interesting about him. He's not there all the time. He's traveling part of the movie. And then he sort of shows up and he sees Spencer Tracy and he's like, harumph, because, you know, maybe Katharine Hepburn might like Spencer Tracy or vice versa or something like that. And he's kind of a dope. So there's the scene that is most often sort of quoted or shown in clips of the movie is the one where Tracy takes Hepburn up to the roof of their office building for lunch, and he basically proceeds to give her sort of an intelligence test. And we can talk about the substance of it, which is pretty funny. But what I think is hilarious is if Tracy is not there, spoiler alert, if he's not there to replace the reference department with the electronic brain, what is the point of giving her the intelligence test? I don't really get that. Like, why
he wants to make one? He could be making sure that she's capable of working with the computer, and he could just be curious. I mean, he knows that she's smart,
right? It's kind of a dope. It's a funny scene though. And
what I like best of it is the setup. You know that he's going to take her out to lunch, and so she figures they're going to go to some fancy little restaurant nearby, and he's very late. and then he goes up to the roof, and it's freezing outside.
Right, so the whole scene, not only are they playing it for comedy, but Hepburn is freezing the whole time, which is it's hilarious. It's really well done. Both of them are funny, and he's really deadpan, and he's like asking her questions about, you know, math word problems about people getting on and off trains, and she is freezing the whole time.
But able to answer the questions
perfectly, she answers all the
and
questions.
In surprising ways.
Right. I like the one where the answer is three pieces of celery and two olives. He asks her a question at the same time he holds out sandwich condiments to her, and she counts them anyway. But supposedly they originally had intended to have them walk to lunch in some way, but they did this movie entirely on the back lot in California. But in order to do a proper walk to lunch, they would have had to film in New York, which was their original plan. And just by not having that walk to lunch, they were able to do it entirely on the back lot and save a whole ton of money. And I forget who came up with the idea of them going on the roof, but it was absolutely done for comic effect. So at that point, she has charmed him and both impressed him with her brain. So, yeah, she has a master's degree, and presumably she says she's been to college and she has took a course at Columbia, which I interpret as she has like a master's of library science or something like that. So a little later on in the movie, through a series of circumstances, she and he end up being driven in a car by a coworker, and they end up at her apartment, which creates some gossip amongst the coworker.
Yeah, they get caught out in the rain, and
yeah, it's a whole thing. Yes. And the point of that is so that when they are having dinner in the apartment and he's wearing a bathrobe because his clothing is wet, then it's a perfect time for the boyfriend who hasn't been around in weeks and weeks to show up and take umbrage. So, yeah.
And then others come in.
Yeah, an awful lot of people show up at that apartment. That's the sort of emotional center, the romantic part of the movie. You want to talk about some computers?
Oh, sure. I mean, certainly a major focus of the movie is the computers. And in 1957, computers still were very new. Computers, I guess, really got their start during the World War II, when they became very useful to the War Department. They were very useful. They could do some things extremely well, such as help crack ciphers. They were very good at that. But that didn't require a lot of memory or actual computer speed. They just had to be a lot faster than people. So they were still very primitive machines. But I guess in the news, they were these marvelous, almost magical devices.
Well, they call it electronic brain.
Oh, yes.
In the 50s, people were already both fascinated by them and kind of afraid of them.
Well, several years earlier, you had the movie, what was it, Forbidden Planet?
Yep.
And, you know, there's a famous science fiction movie where you had, I guess it's Robbie the Robot, who by himself was able to run this whole planet that the civilization had left for some reason. And this planet could do almost magical things with its very, very powerful computer. But so that was still sitting on people's head. But at this time, the computers still were vacuum tubes. The transistor had just barely been invented. They hadn't come up with the circuitry for it yet. And with vacuum tubes, they consume an enormous amount of power and space. And even if you have a vacuum tube that can last several years before burning out, if you have a few thousand of these things in a computer, you're always having a vacuum tube burnout. So you'd have tons of repairs on it. If the temperature in the room changed very much, the vacuum tubes could start popping and going out, you know, in droves. So you had to have these massive air conditioners, these massive computers where they had lots of power. The computers themselves were these rather large boxes, essentially limited in space, in size by how big the elevator shaft was so that you could bring it up to a certain floor. The floors had to frequently be reinforced in order to support the weight of these things. So, you know, you bring a computer into a research department would be an enormous amount of work. You'd have to put in a whole lot of power, a whole lot of air conditioning. It would probably take months to put this thing in. And yes, in the movie they do touch upon, you know, the making sure all the doors were closed properly and that turning the air conditioner way down. And that was very true. They had to do that sort of thing.
So the plot point of the movie is that the computer that they're going to put into the reference department is not going to replace the people, but it's going to free them to do more work and be more productive.
Yes, but everyone's suspicious of this.
As they should be, because we find out that they've put a computer in payroll already, and somehow the computer in payroll fires everyone and gives them literal pink slips. And, you know, our question was, wait, so there was a pink roll of paper already in the... Yeah, how did that even happen? But it was a great way to sort of show, oh my God, the computer's run amok. But of course, Spencer Tracy, who had put the computer in payroll, was able to fix that. We never actually see that computer. We just see that everybody from the CEO on down.
Yeah, even Spencer Tracy gets fired.
Yes.
And Spencer he's not
Tracy,
on the payroll.
Right, he gets fired by the computer.
The CEO gets, everybody gets fired.
So then they bring this thing into the reference department, and it is a floor-to-ceiling thing with lots of blinky lights.
Yeah, they've got this huge panel of blinky lights, and you may have seen it at some point. But I didn't sit down and count the columns and rows, but I suspect that it is 80 columns wide by 12 rows, which would match a card punch, the old Hollerith card.
So can you describe the unit? In addition to the blinky lights, we've got, what, tape drives?
Oh, yeah.
We've got a keyboard. To just sort of describe
They have several tape drives, and the tape drives are rather amusing because if you pay any attention to them at all, one, you realize there's no tape in the tape drives, but they're moving. The reels are moving, and they're moving in the wrong direction. They're moving such that they would snap the tape, or that the tape would just fall all over the floor. You know, they're not, the take-up reel is not taking up and whatnot. Now, this is better than some, I believe it was a James Bond movie that I saw in the 60s where the tape drive somehow had three reels on them, and all three reels were turning. I have no idea what that third reel was supposed to be doing.
The third reel.
Yes. But yeah, that was pretty amazing. Every now and then, when this computer is active, it would sort of spit out multiple punch cards of different colors. I have no idea why it was doing that, but you know, I guess it looks good. And then they had this you couldn't see it very well, but essentially a typewriter where you could the operator would type in questions and receive responses from the computer. Of course, computers of that era did not have such things.
Right. So Spencer Tracy is the mastermind behind the computer. But when they finally install the computer in the reference department, which I guess they do over the holidays, because there's a Christmas interval. Oh, and there's a nice drunken party. Again, if you're a Mad Men fan, you'll appreciate all the whiskey in the office. But then they come back and the computer is installed in the reference department. And they've also brought in a sort of a harried woman who's, I guess, the operator. Although she's an engineer, I guess, because they do talk about her being...
Sure she was very qualified.
Somehow involved in the design of the thing. But basically, the reference department people are not amused by the... So the questions that they ask are things like, what is the weight of Earth? And they type that in, what is the weight of the Earth? And the answer from the computer comes back, with or without people. And Hepburn says how long it took her to look that up by hand, you know, how to divine that information by hand. And so what are some of the other questions they ask the computer?
Oh, Lord. Oh.
I don't remember. I should have written them down.
Yeah, a bunch of them are questions which computers today would not
answer. Was the Corfu thing. It was, right, because somebody calls in to the reference department and asks them. There are several instances in the movie where they are asked to recite poems to great humorous effect. And so they ask about Corfu, and the computer wants to talk about curfew. And so this leads to Katharine Hepburn reading a very... The computer prints out the poem. That's right. It's like 80 stanzas or something.
Oh,
so
yeah,
it kills a lot of trees. But Hepburn does a great dramatic reading of the Corfu poem.
Yes, but as a human, she knows, everyone on the staff knows that of this question and the answer, and that it's a trap, and knows it off the top of her head.
So when you type into the computer, when you type in your question and you hit enter to signal that the computer should begin answering the question, what happens? Can you do an impression of the computer, or am I going to have to do it?
Oh, the sounds.
Boop, 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 boop.
Yeah, that's one of the good sounds.
That's the enter key, essentially. So there's a point at which the computer, as computers in all movies of this era, it gets confused. And it is asked questions that cause it to lose its mind and to sort of overheat. And there's a point at which it's like its lights are flashing, and then it kind of pants.
Yeah, it starts breathing really heavy.
It starts breathing really heavy, and then it dies. And then the solution is that Katharine Hepburn gives Spencer Tracy a hairpin. So I guess he breaks a circuit. And
yes, and was able to go back there and pull a panel
and
open.
Fixes the computer.
Without shocking himself.
Right. And so it's all okay, apparently. They're happy to have this giant computer. And
yeah, I was somewhat surprised that they didn't just have, you know, like in the Star Trek episodes, Landru, please explain, you know, help me, I'm lost.
Well, it was sort of a circle, I guess. But so it ends up being, I guess, a... See, computers can be your friend. I don't know. I don't watch that whole movie where these people are worried about losing their jobs, and at the end they get this computer to help them, and I don't end up feeling better about their job longevity because there's something that I calculated it. It says that the computer will save a certain number of man hours per 6, year.
6,000
man hours. And what I calculated was that it was about the work time of 4 people. That's how many people work in that department.
Yeah.
So.
Except
unless they're going to improve their productivity by adding additional tasks.
The computers then were extremely expensive.
Well, that's a good point too. So, yeah, I think the point is, oh no, a computer can never replace you because it's not good enough to do that. Not that the company wouldn't necessarily want to. I'm sure the company would be in those days. I mean, they have to pay for those giant offices, right?
Yep.
So, the makers of the movie thank IBM at the end, so I guess that's some version of an IBM computer.
Well, I'm sure IBM must have helped them along the way.
Consulted them in some way for random
probably
mentions.
Probably a few props.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And then,
those computers, they were no Googles. They were no Google capable. These machines probably were lucky to have 100, you know, computer words.
Right. How much knowledge? Like, I mean, it seems like the best they could have done is you could ask it a question. It could say, "Get me tape 47," and you put the tape in. Or I don't know what.
They would have ton. Yeah, almost all of the memory in the computer would be on computer tapes, and the most of your time would be spent waiting for the computer to find to reel the tape to the right spot to get the little bit of information that it needed. And then it would jump to the next reel. It would just be constant.
Well, remember, that's why
there's so little memory.
Mainframes had operators. There were people whose job was computer operator.
Oh, yeah.
And that was everything from loading tapes to, you know, making printouts happen and all that kind of stuff.
And these computers, this was before they had operating systems, really.
Yeah.
And computer languages were just beginning. So a lot of this stuff would be written in machine language or in assembler language, very, very low-level stuff, and everything would be extremely customized.
Yeah, I can see how you might be able to apply it to something like payroll, but to something like, you know, Googling, something as referenced like that, it just doesn't seem like it would be
sensible. Yeah, I noticed
sensible.
One of your show notes, it mentioned... they had a computer that translate from Russian to Chinese.
Oh, yeah. So when Hepburn comes in at the beginning of the movie, she says, "I just went to IBM and I saw the electronic brain translate from Russian to Chinese."
Yeah,
that's a neat trick.
Maybe one word. Imagine, among other problems are the alphabets. I would be very surprised if they had Cyrillic and katakana and kanji.
But that's just a picky detail, isn't it?
Yes,
I mean, come on, you're taking all the fun out of it. I guess if you go to see a demo at IBM, they can have a setup that only does those things and only translates the specific stuff that, you know. Here, I can translate "Hi, how are you" from Russian to Chinese.
Which even then would be fairly impressive. You know, if they could do a few things, that would be interesting to look
at. Sure.
Because no one had thought of it before, basically.
So other things I enjoyed in the movie, I did enjoy the Christmas office party drinking scene where Tracy plays the bongos and they sing "Night and Day." And this is like a Shelley Tracy Hepburn geek reference, but "Night and Day" is a Cole Porter song, And in the one of the better movies that they made together, Adam's Rib in 49, Cole Porter wrote a special song for that movie. And so whenever I hear them sing Night and Day in 1957, I think of Farewell Amanda in 1949. Sorry, I just had to get that out there. They end up together. They ask the computer if they would be a good match. And I don't know, the computer doesn't really give a good ruling. I think they have to make that decision as humans.
That's about when the computer dies.
Yeah, again, a failing of technology, right? So... And I don't know if they had, you talk about the need for air conditioning. I mean, that, probably they reinforced the floor, but it's like right out there in the big room where the reference department is. So it doesn't seem like it's suited to that device, not to mention where the tape storage would be.
No. And I'm sure the thing had a giant motor generator. Those are very heavy for a power supply, essentially.
Oh, I've got just a couple of other random things. So we live in 2019. Some people call this PC culture. I don't. It's just the way we speak now.
There are personal computer?
Yes, personal computer. There are a couple references that might raise an eyebrow, but I only think they should raise an eyebrow like halfway. Like there's a joke about the Mexican Avenue bus and about a guy in a serape on the bus. And anyway, there's not like... inappropriate language or stuff that should really be offensive to anyone. But there are a couple of lines in there that you're just aware of it in 2019 that you probably wouldn't say quite the same way. And again, the nice thing about it is very little of it is sexist. The closest to sexism they come in the movie is just the women's focus on marriage and the sort of clueless dudes. And then there is the fact that the CEO has his secretary in his lap at one point. But you... don't really find the women being chased around their desks. And even the dopey boyfriend, Gig Young, as much as he takes his girlfriend for granted, he's not a jerk face, which is good.
And so many movies of that era were that way, that you'd have the men chasing the women or vice versa, and you'd either have the women expecting the men to hit on them or wanting them secretly to hit on them, you know, and saying no means yes and all that crap.
Right, or going through sort of machinations to, like, you know, make the men, manipulate the men in some way, or the men manipulate the women, whatever. That doesn't really happen. So it's pleasant. Like, so what did you think of the movie? Do you enjoy it? Would you recommend it?
Yeah, I recommend it. It is definitely different than anything else that Tracy Hepburn did. And it's a light, fun little movie.
Yeah, I think I like the computer stuff. I like that it's the first movie of theirs that's kind of in a quote-unquote modern era. Of course, it was their first movie in color. It's in CinemaScope. You've got the computer element. And it was the last two movies they did together were written by Kanan and Gordon and directed by George Cukor. And they sort of had this sort of 40s sensibility about them. So it brings them into the modern era. And I do think, as I say... It's a lesser office comedy than a lot of the things that were being done in the last half of the 50s, but it's fun to watch, especially if you enjoy technology and flashing lights and stuff. If you don't enjoy technology and flashing lights and just want to watch it as a romantic comedy, it's pretty straight up mediocre. Watching it again, it's funny because I, as a big fan of Tracy and Hepburn, I have sometimes felt I have lack of objectivity about things like this. Watching it again, I think Hepburn is really good. I think Tracy is kind of plodding along. He's doing as well as he can, but I don't feel like it's an inspired performance. And frankly, it's not an inspired part for him. They built the part up quite a bit for him from the play, the part in the play. I don't think he ends up with Hepburn at the end of the play. I think it's just an obstacle she has to deal with when the computer comes in. But so for the movie, because it was Tracy and Hepburn, they built his part up.
I think he probably did as much as he could with the part he was given. But yeah, he didn't have any inspired performance, which took it beyond what the script did.
But she was really good. Joan Blondell play off each other really well.
Oh, Joan Blondell plays off of other actors very well.
She really does. And that goes back all the way to the 30s, because whenever she was in the pre-code and movie musicals of the early 30s, if you think about most of the great Joan Blondell performances, there's usually another actress involved. They're either, you know, dames with a heart of gold living in an apartment trying to make it in musicals or gold diggers or whatever. And she often has a dude, but most of the time her best performances are either with other women or in ensembles where there are dudes that are, you know, just part of the furniture, so to speak. But it's funny. Not their best, but pretty good. Like I say, it's worth it just for the Amarak at the end.
Amarak.
Amarak. Boop, boop, ba-doom. Yeah, that's... So you can find Desk Set on Blu-ray and DVD for fairly low cost. The DVD version, probably the Blu-ray version too, has a commentary by Dina Merrill. I mentioned at the beginning it's kind of a mediocre commentary because she takes little deviations to talk about her film career and her life. I actually don't think that that's her being an egotistical actress. I think it's just because she didn't have that much to say, and perhaps by the time they did the film commentary, there weren't a lot of people who were still alive. She didn't have a very big part in the movie. She says a lot of nice things about Tracy and Hepburn and a few things about making the movie, which are interesting. You can also find it streaming on Amazon, and it's not going to be on Netflix because movies aren't on Netflix. Let's just get that out of the way right there. But it's available in lots of places for buying, for renting. Do enjoy it on a widescreen television. So what shall we watch next?
Ooh.
Yeah, let me put it this way. So having watched Desk Set, let's pretend we just watched it instead of watching it a week ago. Having just finished up Desk Set and gone into the kitchen to pour yourself a lovely beverage, what would be your second in your double feature? What would you want to watch next?
I'm trying to think if there's another computer movie that's old but still a step up, you know, a few years have passed. And so our expectations of what computers are supposed to be able to
maybe
do.
Maybe we should find your James Bond movie with three tape drives. I don't remember that one, but maybe somebody out there does.
Yeah, I think it was James Bond or one of the knockoffs. You know, maybe it was Dean Martin or some fool thing. He did a few stupid movies along those
with computers?
Lines.
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, there are probably a few computer movies of the 60s, but not being a theme person, I'd probably end up watching Joan Blondell and Mae Clark in some movie from the early 30s, but that's just me.
Well, so. I saw a Joan Blondell movie not long ago where she was, it may have been in the 60s. So yeah, she was much older, but she was not exactly a motherly figure, but it was playing on the part where she was listening and reacting to other people and the actors and added a whole bunch to it.
But. I know what I'd watch. Yeah, there's a movie where she's in Hawaii and it's called Kona Coast, and I haven't seen all of it, but she runs this bar, and there's all sorts of like kind of low-life grifter kind of characters.
It's a pretty wild movie.
And I think that was what I would watch next because it's very like mod. And it's late 60s.
It's intense.
It's intense, but it's like, yeah, I guess if you liked, you know, Hawaii 5-0 or whatever, you're like, I know, let's watch some more Hawaiian Islands stuff from the 60s. Yeah, Kona Coast with Joan Blondell. Let's like make that our recommendation for people's next flick. All right. I feel better now you've recommended it. Well, thanks so much for listening. If you're not a regular listener to Parallel, if you've come here because you're a member of Relay, first of all, thank you very much. Now, a little known fact for those of the shows on Relay like mine that have not yet had a chance to have a sponsor, membership is very important because the money that you spend on your membership makes it possible for me to do what I do. So I want to thank everybody who's a member of Relay. And I also want to say, if you are a Parallel listener who has joined Relay because of Parallel, I especially want to thank you. And I hope you'll tune in to Parallel if you haven't heard it before. It's a podcast about technology with accessibility sprinkles. You can find that at relay.fm/parallel. You can follow the show at Parallel Pods on Twitter. You can follow me personally on Twitter at Shelley. That's Shelly. And Frank is not on the internet. So you...
Yeah, I don't know how it works. I know nothing about it.
He's on the internet. Hey, you have a Twitter. I don't think you use it much.
I haven't used it in over a year.
Right. So anyway, if you want to talk to him, which most people do, I'll give him a message for you. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, she can relay.
So I'll be back with another episode of Parallel real soon. And please enjoy all the rest of the members-only shows this month, which is membership month. Here on Relay. Also, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me. Push the button, Frank.
I am the button.